I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening.
So Patrick, I don't know if you know this, but October is a busy awareness month, especially for the topics we talk about here on this podcast. It is ADHD Awareness Month. It's OCD Awareness Month. It's Depression Awareness Month, Dyslexia Awareness Month, and it's Pregnancy and Infant Loss Awareness Month, which is what we're going to be diving into today. So I do want to just offer kind of a gentle disclaimer. If you are in the process of trying to get pregnant or recently experienced a pregnancy loss, do take care of yourself while listening to this episode, because we will be talking about pregnancy loss. So first, I just streamlined through the intro. Patrick, anything to add to the intro before I introduce our guest?
I have nothing to add. I appreciate laying the groundwork. So that's where
I feel like there's a role reversal. There's a role reversal happening here. Okay.
So tired. I told Megan and Kylie before we got started, been up since 3 a.m. So I'll be here in existence, but maybe also not.
Appreciate how you name how you can come into this space, however you are. So we have Kylie on today, who is, do you go by doctor? Because you're an occupational therapist, right? How do you typically introduce yourself?
Well, my students call me Dr. Hanisch, but Kylie is perfectly fine.
Okay. So Dr. Hanisch, or Kylie, is an occupational therapist, autistic ADHDer, newly diagnosed, you mentioned. And you also started a nonprofit around pregnancy loss to help both, I think, to help families, but also to help educate the medical field around how they can be walking through families and people walking through that process better. Do I have that right?
Yes. Yeah. So we're supporting families who've experienced different types of losses.
Okay.
And then there's a lot of trauma that can be done, like with healthcare providers, and especially in the hospital. And so they don't receive training in their formal education. And so how can we kind of share information to help them be more confident in working with bereaved families, and then therefore reducing trauma and other negative mental health outcomes?
I love that so much. I think I've mentioned it on here a few times, but I used to work as a therapist in an OBGYN clinic. And this was an area where it was evident there was just so much growth for the medical community in how this process is handled. And I love your lens of reducing trauma. So yeah, I'm backing up bird eye view a little bit. We connected because you emailed me. We were asking folks for like topic ideas, and you emailed me with four or five wonderful ideas, but one that caught my eye was autistic grief. And we've heard words. We've heard other followers ask for us to cover autistic grief as well. I think it is a really important and complex topic. So we're going to be looking at that today. We're going to anchor in the experience of pregnancy loss. Partly you reached out because you heard me mention that I had had two pregnancy losses on the podcast, which you have a good ear because I think it was a really passing comment. But I also think once you've lived through pregnancy loss, you hear it when people talk about it. Okay, that was a long-winded intro. To anchor our conversation today, we do have a broad framework we're going to follow. I'm going to make it explicit because I think structure can be helpful. We're going to talk through different phases of the pregnancy loss experience. And I think this is really important to think through it in phases, in the sense that this is actually something we know helps people walk through the grief process, is when they can storytell and narrate their experiences. So we'll be talking about the acute phase of coming to know, the processing around that, the postpartum experience, and then grieving itself. And when we get to that fourth part, we're going to globalize it to talk more broadly about autistic grief. Does it sound like I have that right, Kylie, of what we talked about?
Yeah. Okay. And I think just so for other people who are listening that have not experienced pregnancy loss, or maybe have, but other types of loss, like loss isn't only death. And that you can take what we're talking about and apply it to your own situation, because it will be in some way relatable. It just may not be the exact same story. But I think there's a lot of lessons that can be just like, well, lessons learned, and then just like exploring for yourself, like, well, how did I react and what, you know, my interactions with that, I don't know. It's complicated for sure.
Yeah. And I love how you're broadening it of there is, yeah. Okay. Struggling with words this morning. Kylie, I think I'm trying to figure out how to get into our conversation. Should I just hand it over to you?
I mean, you can maybe just ask me to share
how you,
like that, how I learned and how I react, and like we can just jump into. I'm fine. I don't.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not great with transitions either. So,
yeah, that whole social lubricant thing. Okay. So, Kylie, can we go back to starting, kind of at the beginning for you of your experience around pregnancy loss, but then also how you got interested in this topic of autistic grief, and then supporting families and people through this process.
I'll first start just by sharing, like, setting the stage of like my situation. So in 2005 I was pregnant with my first child. You know, everything was fine for the most, you know, up until then. I was 35 weeks pregnant, which is like 5 weeks before due date. And I started bleeding. And because it's my first child, like, you don't know what's normal and what's not normal. And so my midwife told me that it was like, oh, you probably just lost your mucus plug. And so I didn't think anything about it. I had no awareness of baby movement because no one told me to pay attention to it. And there's this like, myth that babies slow down when they're, you know, getting bigger because there's less room, which is not true. But, you know, there was no talk about pay attention to baby movement or anything. So I wasn't even aware of baby movement. But thinking back, I'm like, yeah, I didn't really feel him move. So when I went to the doctor the next day, they couldn't find a heartbeat. They did an ultrasound. And at that point told me that he had passed away. And, I went into immediate shock. I was by myself. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what that meant. And it was just like, I feel like I really left my body. And I said to the provider, I said, well, what am I supposed to do? Like, I didn't, I wanted to understand, like, okay, my baby's dead, but then what happens, you know? And, and I know I'd mentioned this to you before, but then she says, well, maybe you could cry. And I was just like, no, that's not what I'm asking. I'm like, I'm asking for you to tell me what is going to happen. Because you, when you're that pregnant, you have to deliver your baby. Yeah. They're not, unless there's like a threat to your life, they're not going to do a C-section.
Yeah.
But I don't even like, I'm like, how does the baby come out? Like, I don't.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was, go ahead.
I pause there just that, like, that feels really powerful of in that moment, you needed to know what to expect to get back into your body, to get back to safety, and how that was, that probably really threw the medical provider off of like, where's the emotion? We should process the emotion and then talk about logistics, which I think would be a very holistic way of moving through grief. But for you, I almost wonder if you needed to know what to expect to have enough safety to experience your emotions.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like the, right, like I'm just learning about myself, like with the autistic piece, the uncertainty brings so much more fear and anxiety in a situation that's already horrible.
Yeah.
And from her, I got nothing. Like, and I'm not going to go into details, but just like her obsessing about other things that were really not important. And then she sent me home and I was already in labor actually, which is really odd.
That is odd.
It's, you know, and then even at the hospital the following day, very little telling me what was going to happen, what to expect. And then also like once your baby is born, there are lots of things. I mean, this is going to sound creepy to some people or strange or whatever, but like there's a lot of things you can do to make memories, to parent your child. That it seems strange to talk about, but it's like your only time with your baby.
It's really important. Yeah. I actually went to a training on this about how important it is to touch your baby, be with your baby, take pictures with your baby. And from an attachment lens, just how important that is. I literally have shivers talking about it. And how rarely parents are given that opportunity unless the medical system really understands how important that is.
Yeah. And so it's just like, what I really needed was a guide. I mean, I needed the doctor or the nurses or a social worker, someone to be a guide.
Yeah.
Who's like, you haven't been through this, but here's what's going to happen. And here are things that you can choose to do if you want to do that, that could be helpful to you. And I didn't get any of that. And so like the trauma in the hospital was so horrible. And then just also like when you're in that state of shock, and I think this is anyone, it's like, then they took my baby out of the room. They put him in a box in front of me, like to take to the morgue. And it's like, but then also you're just like, I can't even talk. Like, I don't even know what to say. And it's just like trauma upon trauma was really, really hard for me.
Yeah.
So I think that there was, from that point, like there was just too much without any guidance. And I just shut down. And I shut down for like 6 months. I don't remember very much from the 6 months following. So that was kind of, I would say, the like acute phase, but it lingered.
Well, it lingered. I mean, going back to those post-birthing rituals, it lingered partly because you didn't get, I mean, I'm sure it lingered for many reasons, but you didn't get to say goodbye. And I feel so much heaviness hearing you talk through that of there was, it was such ambiguous grief in the sense that there wasn't a goodbye, and there wasn't clarity around what was happening. I think for any human, that's incredibly difficult. And then throw being autistic on top of that, it's just so much.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you want to share any of your experiences in terms of like finding out like that part?
Because I think there's some similar patterns. I think I also, and this is probably for my own self that I'm saying this, you know, I know that whenever we're comparing grief, that's not like a helpful thought experiment. I think it also, for me, I do want to name that it feels like we're comparing apples and oranges, in the sense that from my own experience and walking with a lot of people through this, first trimester miscarriage, 35 week stillbirth are very different experiences. So I want to name that. I did share some of that medical confusion. I had two complicated first trimester miscarriages, one in which my HCG kept going up, which is the hormone that says you're pregnant. So there's about a 3-week window where it's like, well, actually, maybe you're still pregnant. And I kept getting conflicting messages from nurses when I would call, like, well, your HCG is rising, but it's not doubling. Maybe there were twins and you lost one and another one's in there. So there's like a 3 or 4 week, I was getting a lot of mixed information. And that was really hard for me, of like, am I supposed to be grieving right now? Am I still pregnant? Like, so just that. And that's actually more common than I think people realize. There can sometimes be this roller coaster, especially in early pregnancy, of maybe I'm losing the pregnancy, maybe I'm not. And then my second pregnancy was a missed miscarriage, which means that a heartbeat never developed, but the miscarriage didn't organically happen. So it wasn't identified till 9 weeks. And then similarly, I didn't know what to ask and I didn't know what to look for. And I was reading a lot of things from like kind of natural childbirth and midwives. And I love the work of midwives. And at the same time, I think it can set up, it's very much set on typical pregnancies, a lot of the advice. And as an autistic person, I got really attached to the right way of being pregnant and the right way of walking through a pregnancy loss. So I was, and this was my second pregnancy loss, and we very much wanted to have another child. So I was convinced I shouldn't do a DNC because that might scar, it might cause scarring, which could impact future pregnancies. That led to what I think at the end of it, I essentially was like in my first trimester hormones for 20 weeks because I started miscarrying at 12 weeks and then miscarried for 8 weeks. And should have sought medical advice, should have known what to ask for, but I didn't. And I'm kind of medically, I have some medical avoidance. So I didn't actually get help until I started developing an infection. So there was a lot of uncertainty around those times. I wasn't advocating for myself very well. And I think partly because I was also very shut down. I responded by shutting down similarly. I was confused by kind of the absence of emotions during that period. So yeah, that was my experience. What happened when you went home from the hospital and when you made it through after those 6 months? You talked about 6 months of shutdown. What happened after that?
I felt somewhere a shift inside of me of like the wanting to engage in life again. Hmm. And then soon, and that was like a month of that maybe, or maybe even less, but and then I found out I was pregnant with my daughter.
Okay.
Which I hadn't had a chance to grieve. And then like grief process, whatever. And then pregnancy after loss, It's just like anxiety, on steroids.
It is anxiety on steroids.
It's crazy. And so that was a whole nother thing. Mm-hmm.
And did that, again, I'm thinking about potential education. When I was in the medical setting, I did a lot of education of like, after pregnancy loss, there can be a lot of anxiety. You might find yourself resistant to attached to the baby growing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, did anyone walk you through that?
Which is why I created everything I created. I created the guide for the hospital. All this stuff. Because it's like, when I learned things like, well, people knew this, why didn't they tell me? Or why aren't they, you know? And it's like, I feel like the OBs are dealing with the waist down. They don't want to touch the emotion piece. Mm-hmm. And if there's a problem, they don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Nobody, like, unless you get fortunate to have a therapist who knows about this, mm-hmm. really, it's like luck. No, it's just like, there's nothing. You're just like going blindly into everything. Mm-hmm. And it's, you feel like you're going crazy. You can't talk about how you're going crazy because other people are going to think you're crazy.
Well, and especially when you start showing and people start coming up to you. I mean, like outside of pregnancy loss, right? Like I hated being pregnant when people would come up to me and touch me and like be like, are you so excited? And then I'm expected to have this positive emotion. Right. That was just hard for me, even with my first pregnancy before any pregnancy losses. But throw in there, like, I am so anxious and that this baby will survive. And then strangers are coming up and like expecting you to be all teary. Yeah. Did you have some of that experience?
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, it was my first also. So like when I was pregnant again, like, oh, is this your first? And then the whole question, it was like, well, do I tell them about, well, I had a baby that died, or do I not? And most of the time, personally, I feel like my business is my business and I don't need to tell other people my business. It's not, you know, but you feel like you're like kind of disrespecting your child.
Absolutely.
You know,
absolutely. And it's that small talk, right? It's small talk that is so painful. Like I've since learned there's so many questions we ask pregnant people. I've since learned not to ask, like, are you planning to have more? Is this your first? Like things that we think are small talk is not small talk. And that's for non-autistic people too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let alone throw in the, like, we hate small talk component.
Yeah. I had a thought, but it went. Oh no, I know what I was going to say. In the pregnancy after loss piece, like there was like what you were starting to say is like denial of the pregnancy, not attachment, which is called emotional cushioning. So you're like,
oh, I like that term.
I found that word somewhat recently and I'm like, oh, or term, you know? And so it's like, oh, there's an explanation of like fear of getting attached, you know, because maybe the baby will die. And like the thought is, well, if I'm not as attached and the baby dies, it won't hurt as bad, mm-hmm. which is a joke, but it's your brain trying to protect itself. Mm-hmm. And just like not, I didn't buy anything. I didn't want to shower. I was like, no, we're not doing anything to prepare. Like, so I did nothing.
Setting up a nursery or a lot of this, you did none of that.
The second time. No, because I did it the first time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I had to take it all down. So that I was like, no way.
Yeah. No, that's actually really logical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I will just throw in here, like looking at our agenda. Lou's agenda is postpartum. So I will say after you lose a baby, even though your baby's not living, you're still in postpartum. But I was in such shock and like disorientation, it didn't really matter. But after my daughter was born, my second pregnancy, I went into, I don't even know what it was, undiagnosed for 10 years, whatever. I just suffered a lot, but it was like total hypervigilance, anxiety, But now, I mean, so I first diagnosed myself with like postpartum PTSD, like a few years ago. But now I'm wondering is like, how much it is it like sensory overload of being a parent? Like, I mean, or both.
I would argue both.
Yeah. And so
snap on top of each other in really brutal ways.
I was a disaster. I feel like, and this is nothing to like say bad things about my children, but becoming a parent broke me. Like it turned me crazy into like my mental health. It just was never the same. And I think part of it's like, with things I used to do to self-regulate that I didn't know were self-regulation strategies were no longer possible once I have children. And just the feeling of like being claustrophobic and constantly on and all of that. Touch. So,
yeah, Kylie, first of all, just thank you for saying that. Thank you for saying becoming a parent broke me. I think, again, like we've got to hold space for so many complex emotions. And I think this gets really tricky to talk about as a parent. Of course, we love our children. I'm so thankful for my children. I wouldn't have life any other way, but I feel similarly. So my children are now 13 and 10. So I'm through the thick of it, I would say. Those 10 years, especially those 5 years, when they were like two neurodivergent children, I didn't know were neurodivergent. No one was sleeping. They're sensory seekers. Like I was so, first of all, tired. And I think partly because of the pregnancies and complications, my body felt very broken. I wasn't sleeping. The being touched and sounds all of the time, having a hyperverbal toddler talking all the time. Like for someone with a sensitive sensory system, that's a lot to absorb. And I think there can be a lot of shame, especially for mothers around like, why is it so hard?
Yeah.
So, and I did the hypervigilant thing especially with my second. Like,
well, and then you're worried they're going to die, like constantly, yep. Like, are they breathing?
Yep.
Yeah. All that. So it's just so complex, all of it. Yeah.
I imagine that there's this like really confusing, simultaneously like held grief experience. Obviously, I cannot relate, but where it's not only postpartum and grief around loss, but then there's also grief around loss of identity because as a parent, your identity is completely shifted and changing. And then you have to hold space for, I'm grieving the loss of who I was or what my role was or how I moved through the world. Now I'm also grieving this newfound role in my life and I'm kind of there. It sounds like there's a lot of shame inducing experience too of like, I'm not getting it right. Why do I feel this way? That's so complicated and that's so heavy to have to carry.
I love that, Patrick, like that inclusion of identity. I don't know about your experience, Kylie, but like that was huge for me. I was kind of coming out of academia. I just finished my first graduate degree. And I thought I was going to love being a stay-at-home mom. I now understand like how much of my identity comes through my interests and my values. And my husband will talk about this. It felt like I was like trying to find something to orbit in those years. Like I remember I got really into sewing and I got really into like kombucha making and all the DIY stuff, but none of it like felt robust enough. And then the shame of like, why am I not content as a stay-at-home parent?
Yes, I agree. And looking at other people, well, number one, like I couldn't leave the house very often because I was like obsessed with nap schedules and it just overwhelmed me and all that. But then all the other people like, oh, I'm taking my baby everywhere and all that. And then being a bereaved parent on top of that, you can't go into normal spaces with parents and children because you're like, I've just been through like a trauma and you don't understand. And so it's way different. It's, I mean, I feel like there's a whole nother parenting episode here.
There's a lot.
There's a lot. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. Did you find community? Like,
no, I did not. I was very isolated. It was super isolating. It was hard.
Yeah.
And I also feel like my interests are not, I cannot be a stay-at-home mom. Like, I am a disaster. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm good at all the things and all that, but it's just like there isn't enough like intellectual meaning and purpose.
Yes. I literally said, like, I feel like my brain is atrophying.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then not being able to connect to other parents, even like as kids go through school, like I'm so intense and I'm like wanting to talk about like things that I care about, and being able to talk to men more than women, because men mm-hmm. talk about things, whereas women just small talk.
Yep.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. I think mom culture has been the hardest place for me to integrate. And I didn't understand it for so long that brought on a lot of shame. But I have like a visceral response to mom culture. I actually hosted last year an autistic moms group, and it was the first time that I felt connected in a group with other moms.
Yeah. Well, and we're doing, there's this woman, Moina Talser, who wrote an article, a qualitative study of sensory experiences of autistic mothers, which I recently read and was like, oh, this explains everything. And then with my students, we kind of took that and one other article and did a survey with autistic mothers to just understand their experiences and right. Like they're all diagnosed post children, and just all the things that are hard for mm-hmm. them that are different than, I mean, parenting in and of itself is really hard anyways, but you add the autistic piece and the sensory challenges and the all that, it's fascinating. So
I would love to see your research from that. I think, I think, you know, I've shared this before, maybe it's changed by now, but if you Google like, you know, autism and pregnancy or anything related, to kind of birthing, you'll find a lot about like how to avoid having autistic children, but the experience of the person birthing who's autistic, like we're only now beginning to get curious about that experience.
Yeah.
And go.
Well, I was going to say like that there's like the pregnancy itself. So the interaction with mm-hmm. medical providers, the sensory pieces in the hospital, the, all that. And then there's the after. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. But I even remember like with my last child, so I have two living children now, but I went in and it was like a very quick, like 1 hour I got to the hospital and he was born. But like I hired a doula for that one because I wanted to like reclaim my birth experience. And she and my husband were talking the whole time. And I was like, just shut up. Because like when I was there, like, I don't know, for me, I mean, labor for everyone's different, but I was very much in a meditative state. And I just like, why are you talking? And then I have the nurses like, oh, well, we need to do this. And what, like all these questions. And I was like, I'm in labor. Like, just nobody talk to me right now. And even like the doula did not understand pregnancy after loss. And it was like telling me, at 8 months, well, you should probably talk to your baby. You know, you're having a baby. And I was like, you have no idea. So, I mean, that's the other thing. It's just like, I'll just, my nonprofit, which I don't even think we said the name of, is Return to Zero Hope. And my husband made a film about our experience called Return to Zero that like is a feature film and has Minnie Driver in it. She did an incredible job. So it's like emotionally our story, but with the nonprofit, we have all of these free webinars on there, mm-hmm. some for healthcare providers, some for parents, right? Just like educating and empowering people, which I think is so important. And so that's just my little shout out. No, there.
Please talk about your resources. I mean, these are the resources. And I love this. Like, you built what you would have wanted and needed. Actually, I feel like I see that a lot with autistic people. Like when we have an experience, it's like, okay, how can I build the thing I didn't get? Yeah. And I love that you've done that. So yeah, please.
Yeah. I mean, so
they're like, what resources for like pregnant and birthing people?
So, I mean, so first of all, I'll just say to like normalize this, the film didn't come out until 9 years after our loss, a long time. And the first like women's healing retreat I held, which is the first thing I did, was 9 years after the loss. So yeah. It was a long time. Yeah. And so I tell people, like, you know, I think people want to do something. They like there sometimes there is that urge. And for me, it took a lot of time until I feel it's a very spiritual journey mm-hmm. for me. Like I heard a voice in the shower that said, you should do a retreat. I'd never been to a retreat. I never hosted, didn't know anything. But it came from this email I received about there was a lack of resources and a lack of connection of other bereaved parents. And I hadn't had any support. It was like this isolated me and my husband for 9 years. We understood, but no one wanted to bring it up to us because they thought that it would bother us. And I mean, what if that's a whole nother thing. So
yeah,
with that, I started doing that. Now that's been an evolution and now has evolved. We do in-person retreats. Mm-hmm. We're doing a provider retreat in 2024, which I'm so excited about because, I mean, first of all, providers after COVID, it's mm-hmm. so hard, but also providers working in perinatal health, perinatal mental health, mm-hmm. it's hard and there's nowhere for them to go. So
yeah, it's one of the highest burnout professions among physicians is OBGYN, which like I think makes so much sense. People often think about like working in OBGYN as like, oh, it's all happy, but no, it can also be traumatizing for providers in a different way. Yeah. But I love that you're thinking also through building resilience and community among providers.
Yeah. So then, and then with the pandemic, I think there's been a lot of gifts with being able to do virtual support groups, reaching people who are anywhere in the world, really, because a lot of people, even if there was an in-person group before the pandemic, a lot of people don't live in places where they can attend. And so we do a really unique structure. And I think everything, my partner, Betsy, in the nonprofit, like we have really pooled our life experiences and sort of unknowingly created resources that are neurodivergent affirming and trauma sensitive and resilience focused. And I think that what we offer is really unique. And so like with our support groups, they're 6 weeks closed support groups. So it's the same people. So you can build community, but there's trying to create safety as much as possible. We have a curriculum that we follow. We walk people through things that you don't even know that you need to know about grieving and navigating life after loss. And then the group itself is very structured. And like, we did this because I would never go to a support. I went once. Right when the movie was coming out. And I was like, maybe I should go and process. And I went to this group. It was in a hospital, which first, hospitals freaking scare me. Secondly, the facilitation, it was in the cafeteria. So it was like uncomfortable. And it was zero structure. And it was like people just telling their traumatizing stories. And I was like, and I left and I was just like, at a certain point, and I also like get tired early in the night because my brain's been on all day. And I just got up and left at a certain point. I'm like, I'm not sitting through this. But being like in our groups, it's like very structured. Like we have a topic, we have a psychoeducation piece, we have a discussion question, people answer one by one. So there's no like crosstalk. Then there's like weaving it in and then there's self-reflection, but it's very tightly structured.
I love that. I love that.
So like, and I love it too. I would never do any, like, and I tell people even at the retreat, I was like, I would never go to a retreat, but don't worry. Like we got you here. Like it's all super tightly held. And I feel like really holding space is what we are doing. And it, and so there's all sorts of different support groups. You know, we started out with pregnancy and infant loss, and now there's early pregnancy loss, recurrent loss and infertility, termination for medical reasons, people of color. We do like an LGBTQ drop-in group, pregnancy after loss, parenting after loss.
Oh my goodness, you do so much. Like, because those are all such different experiences.
Yeah.
I love how attuned you all are.
Yeah. Well, and for example, before, I would say people who had a TFMR, termination for medical reason, that they could just come to the pregnancy and infant loss. I was like, yeah, of course you're welcome. You lost your baby. And some would come, but like, no, they have a very unique experience. And that group is sells out all the time. And we're the only like pregnancy and infant loss organization who sees that as a loss. I think there's a lot of groups out there who feel like it's abortion and they're not going to be supportive of that. And I'm like, but these people, you don't understand. It's not, yes, they made a choice, but it's not like they, you know, it's for their health sometimes, or the baby is going to die or live a very disabled life. And you don't even know, you cannot get the information that you need. I mean, so it is a very specific space that needs their own space.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. What other things do we offer? Just the website itself is a wealth of education information. We have downloadable PDFs, everything that is all free. We have beautiful printed brochures for provider offices. It's all like, for example, partners grieve too, grandparents, siblings, loss of multiples, like early pregnancy loss, Anita wants to like all these different things. So there's so many different topics. And then the webinars I mentioned. So like we have a YouTube channel with different playlists, which is amazing. And then for providers, we offer monthly provider consultation groups. One is for like more of the hospital medical providers. Mm-hmm. One is more for mental health providers. And I don't know. I mean, that's kind of the main. We have a pregnancy and infant loss directory also. I forgot about that. So like that has
really helpful
local and virtual resources, depending on whether you need like counseling therapy or like a support organization, psychiatry. Like I'm really tied into Postpartum Support International, which offers like the perinatal mental health certification. Yeah. So reproductive psychiatrists. I send everyone, I'm like, you need to see a reproductive psychiatrist. Regular psychiatrists do not know.
Yeah, they don't
about like they give you the wrong information. And I'd be like I had someone working for me who became pregnant and they were on an antidepressant and the psychiatrist says, no, get off of it. And I said, even the OB. And I was like, and she was not able to get out of bed. I was like, oh no, we need to get you to someone who knows what they're doing.
That's scary. Yeah. I think you built neurodivergent, like accessible resources without even realizing that's what you're doing just by being you and by caring, you built this and like, cause right. Only in the last year you discovered
I did like a self-diagnosis in December, which was like, 9-ish months ago. And then a formal diagnosis. Cause I wanted to see what was going on with like trauma, there's a significant amount of trauma from all of this, the stillbirth and stuff like that. But I got a formal diagnosis of, you know, autism, ADHD, plus some other mood disorder stuff. Yeah. But I knew it all. So now I'm like very much advocate of self-diagnosis. I was like, you know what? Totally. This didn't really do anything. I mean, it validates me. And there's not something else hidden in there. But I was like, whatever. I'm like...
I love because I think sometimes it can be put on this pedestal, like medical diagnosis. All of a sudden, huge things will change. But I love they're like, you know, yeah. No.
Well, and then it's like they're like, oh, here's your diagnosis. Okay, good luck. Nothing. And I was like, if I was that person, obviously they're not neurodivergent. If I was the person doing the assessment, I would be like, hey, here's the whole website I built. Here's the all the blah, 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 you know, kind of like what you did. That would be something that I would do. But they just like, okay, there you go. Mm-hmm. So.
Which parallels your experience around pregnancy loss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I also feel like, and I cannot take this on right now, but the gap in like autistic adults, like giving information and just like, but how many people I talk to now who share, I mean, they share the same. Oh, my kid has autism. And I'm like, and then I self-disclose. And then they're like, I think I might too. And then I was like, here's my Google Drive with a bunch of stuff, which is totally informal. But I'm like, here's a bunch of stuff I put together. Go read it.
I love that. You're so good at like systematizing and building systems. And I love that.
It's like a superpower that I didn't even know that I had. But it's,
you know. But it's so, I mean, I think going back to that, kind of that initial experience of coming to know, so many of us soothe by getting access to information and that psycho-ed piece. I mean, that's something you are so good at, is building like, here's the things that are helpful for you to know about your experience, about your body, about what to expect. I do. I'm cognizant of time. And I think the part on our agenda we maybe didn't hit was around the grieving process. And I know that you mentioned, like, I think there were some collective rituals or practices that you felt were helpful or that were distinct as an autistic person. Do you want to share a little bit about the grieving process?
Well, okay. I mean, I think actually for me, up until I started doing the retreats, there was not a lot. You know, there was basically like, I didn't have any guidance. I don't know. And at that point, the internet was like not really a thing. It was so long ago. And so I feel like my connection was very private, and I connected, or my son appeared to me as a white butterfly. Like, I feel like the deceased of any kind can send us messages through animals, insects, things like that, or signs, different, you know. There's a great couple of books out there by a medium named Laura Lynn Jackson, The Light Between Us and Signs. And I just love it. Just basically the veil between this world and the other world is very thin. And I think I had a lot of like psychic abilities in terms of like being able to like, cause I'll hear everything with Return to Zero has been inspired by other. I'm a very, very left brain person. So this is not how I operate. However, it is very much nothing I ever would have thought I would do. It was like I was being chosen to do this. And I know that sounds woo-woo, but it's just...
I actually love it because I'm so similar to you. I'm so science-based, except when it comes to like collective energy, spirituality, and like... I sometimes say I feel like a lot of autistic people would have been shamans in a past life, like in historic times, of like, I've definitely had moments of knowing when something's about to happen, or like these spiritual experiences that I'm like, this does not fit within my scientific frame. But yes, so I actually love that. And I know it sounds woo-woo too, so I often don't talk about it. And these are very real experiences I've had and that I know a lot of autistic people have.
Yeah. And so I think there, you know, I didn't really do a lot. It was through the retreats, through other people who are even more connected to the spirit, I would say, that the importance of bringing in ritual and collective ritual. So, and I think the biggest things we do are we like, light a candle, like we sit in we have like our group circle and we have like this, I'll say altar, but it's not, it's just on the floor. And we have candles with every baby's name tied around the candle. And we light it every morning when we sit down, and we, each person lights their candle, they say their baby's name. So I would say, I'd say Norbert, and everyone else would say Norbert. And just like, you don't ever get, if you named your baby, not all people do, but you don't ever get to hear their name spoken. And so it's really powerful. So like that's something that we do as a group. We also allow people, we set up like a memorial table that people can bring things or pictures, whatever, because that's also something that people don't always put out in their home, or they put it out, but it's in this like a more private space. So I don't do a lot, and I sometimes feel bad about it, right? Like it, but I know that that's just me. There isn't, you know, I think like grieving. No, it's just like, right. There are societal expectations.
Yes. Yes.
Agree. And also gender expectations.
Yes. Yes. And those, especially I think for autistic women, those conflate, because especially if we have alexithymia, like I definitely experienced that through my grief, specifically around my pregnancy losses. If I'm not doing this right, there's a right way to grieve this, and I'm not doing it right.
Yeah. Like I never cry. I mean, occasionally, but it is rare. And so like after my loss, I didn't cry. My husband was way more emotional than I was. And I was just like super stoic. And I go to these retreats, and the last retreat I actually knew I was autistic. And so I said to everyone, I was really excited. I was like, hey, just to let you know, I'm autistic and I don't show a lot of emotion. So it might look like I'm really stoic, but I do have a ton of emotion inside of me. It just doesn't show. And when I'm there, I'm also, it takes a tremendous amount of concentration and energy to hold space. And like when Patrick talks about his retreats, I'm like preaching to the choir. Like I do this now, I know, and I have to go like take a little sensory cocoon nap in the middle, like in the afternoon, but the draining, like I am drained at least a week after, like I cannot schedule anything. And then you're like, at what cost? But it is so, such a powerful experience. And it is such an honor to be with these women. It's so powerful. You can't even put words to it. And it drains the life out of me. So it's very interesting, but
Yeah. Well, and there's some interesting research that like we're more impacted by kind of the affect of people around us. We don't always know how to identify it, which actually makes it kind of more of a sensory load, but that we pick up energy tone, a lot of us, very sensitively. So, and again, that disconnect of like, look, maybe looking really flat, but being so deeply impacted by the emotional tone. I would think, especially in grief spaces, that's a complex autistic experience.
Yeah. I mean, I am hyper empathic and hypersensitive to other people's energy. Like, and that's also like, I know auditory is one of my big sensitivity areas, but energy, like literally someone walks in the room, I can sense what's going on. Even if I drive outside and there's like, we had a hurricane warning here a few weeks ago. And like, I didn't even put it together, but I went to the grocery store and everyone was like, and I was like, what the heck is going on? Like just superpowers, but it's hard to say what it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. More about grieving. Like, I mean, I think the one big one is like not grieving as other people think you should be grieving.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great global, like whether it's a death of a loved one, whether it is an identity shift. I think that's a really global, like autistic experience of the way we grieve, especially what people observe from the outside doesn't always match kind of the cultural expectations.
Yeah. And then I think there's also the false belief in like old grief culture that like, oh, like you get over your grief, you move on from your grief. And about three, I feel like for me, and I think this is similar, like people are really great for about 3 weeks after something bad happens. And then they all continue to go on their life. And your life,
yeah,
it's like there's a before and an after. Your life will never be the same. And you're just like standing there in shock. And you're like, what the heck? You're like, my life, I can't go on. And so it's this long, long process of integration and processing. And other people like, well, you look better. Or you seem better. You know, things like that. Like, and maybe even not to me, I don't know, but I hear this all the time. And you're like, well, this is complicated. And this just doesn't happen over a week or a month. Like, grieving is a lifetime and it changes. And like, it's not linear at all. There's no stages. And it's like back and forth and up and down. And you and your partner are grieving on different timelines and different like phases. And it's messy.
So messy. So messy, especially with the, yeah, the kind of co-grief. If someone is partnered and then the timelines don't always like sync up, and that can create confusion and kind of disconnect. Yeah. Yeah. I love how you're talking about grief. Of I'll often talk about like, yeah, learning how to carry the grief well, but I love your language of integration and the, yeah, this myth that it's like something we get over and then move on from versus like it becomes part of us and we live with that in an integrated way.
And I think for like, well, for anyone that dies, you're, so in my case of my stillbirth, like I still celebrate my son's birthday. He just turned, we would have been 18 this past July. But people do that. That will be forever. But even with loved ones who die or not babies, like you're going to remember their birthday. You might remember their death day. Like those are days to like, whether you do something or not, it is a touch point, I think. But other people around you don't see that necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. They forget the touch points and Yeah.
You were going to say something, but you probably forgot.
It's like, it was in response to something you said like two comments ago. So connect. Now I was just going to share, I appreciate the wave metaphor of grief. That was during my first, I was 18 when I first had my significant loss. My best friend in high school died of a brain tumor. And learning, like I remember the first week or two, it was just constant. And then I remember the very first time I forgot that David had died, I was in a movie theater and maybe I forgot for 5 minutes and then it hit me like a wave. And that idea of at first, like the wave, it's like a tidal wave, it's constant. And then there might be some spacing out of the waves, but like it can catch you off guard. Like maybe it's been a stretch since there's been a wave, but there'll be some remembrance.
Yeah.
And a wave can just kind of be like a sneaker wave and catch you off guard. But that imagery of waves was really helpful in that, in my initial grief of like just understanding that this is a process and it ebbs and it flows. And there's some really heavy grief days and there's lower impact days.
And I think also like one thing I experienced myself, but also hear a lot is, you know, you will over time have moments of respite from that intense grief.
Right.
And hopefully those moments get more often and longer, but there is this connection, like there is an attachment with you to your loss or your baby through the pain.
Yes.
And so you start feeling guilty if you don't feel the pain, or you begin to feel moments of joy. And so teaching people that okay, we don't only have to connect through pain. We can also connect through joy. Or through other ways. Like there's lots of ways to connect. And so you can let go of the pain and still remain connected. So I thought that was like something else that I learned.
I love that. 'Cause you're absolutely right. That can lead to complex grief. In the DSM, there's a diagnosis of complex grief when essentially when people kind of get stalled in the grief process. And I think it's part of that of, I don't want to release my pain because this is my attachment to that person. So I love your expansion of it. There's so many ways that we can continue that attachment beyond pain.
Yeah. And so like the term or a term is continuing bonds. Mm-hmm. You can go out there and Google that. And the idea that, yes, there is a physical relationship that is not there, but there's an other, there's mm-hmm. other relationships that can continue.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
I'm going to put a plug. I don't know what you think of this theory, but since you said continuing bonds, I'm going to put a plug out for Warden's Four Tasks of Grieving. I much appreciate that to the stages of grieving. They're action. They're like active steps that a person takes in the process of grieving, and they're nonlinear. So there's four tasks, and the thought is like, you will be in one of these tasks, like, and you'll go back and forth. And it's a process, but one of them has to do with the continuing bonds. And I'll put a link in there, but that's another great, if someone is experiencing, especially the loss of a loved one, I think Warden's Tasks of Grieving can provide a framework, which again is helpful for autistic people, to learn how to integrate that loss and live with it.
Well, I'll look it up.
Yeah. I'll send you a link.
I know we're sort of running short. I just have one other thing that I mm-hmm. didn't really think out about before that I think is important. So, right, as autistic people, our friend circle can be small, very small.
Yes.
And so I know that like we talk about like in our relationships module, like with your partner, that your partner is also grieving and you can't be the only support for each other. Mm-hmm. However, when you're autistic and you don't have a lot of other people to talk to, that's really hard. And for years, the amount of therapists I try to find that didn't understand my experience at all. I mean, so being really lonely, and it wasn't until I met other people who had been through this that I was like, oh my gosh, like you get what I've been through. And it's the same as being autistic, but just like being with other people who have been through this type of loss and not having to explain yourself, like those are my closest relationships now. But it's lonely.
Yeah. I think after this episode records, if you start an autistic pregnancy loss group, I think that would fill up really fast.
But the question is, do people know they're autistic?
Oh, that's, you know, but here's it, probably not. Like I definitely didn't when I was going through it. And I would imagine a lot of people, even 5-10 years later, would still benefit actually from.
Yeah.
Because I do think that we perhaps are more prone to getting stalled in our grief process because of alexithymia, mm-hmm. because of interoception, because of lack of community. So I actually think people who have now since discovered they're autistic, even if this was 10, 12 years ago, like would still benefit.
Yeah, very
you can test my hypothesis. We'll let me know.
Or you can be like, if you suspect you're autistic.
Yes.
If you have an autistic child or you're highly sensitive.
Because you're a highly sensitive person.
Because I attached to the highly sensitive person thing about like 5 years ago. Like that was my language.
That's the pathway for a lot of, especially women, I notice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. That's all. I mean, we could keep on talking forever, but. There's a lot of things in here.
There are so many interweaving themes, which is kind of what we do here. We try to create space for how complex these topics are. And I think we definitely did that today. There's a lot of interweaving pieces here between identity, autism, loss, grief, advocating in medical systems. There's a lot here. Yeah. Thank you so much for the generosity of your time. Like I know you're wildly busy, but also just the generosity of sharing of yourself and your experience and of the community that you've built. I think it's interesting. This episode might be listened to less because people will see the title and be like, I don't relate to that. But I think the people that listen to this will be so deeply impacted because of what you said of there are so few spaces for autistic people to talk about this and our worlds tend to be small. So I think the impact of this episode for those who relate to this subject, I think will be really incredible. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. Like, I feel like I have been devouring your podcasts. I've been like, I haven't done this so deep dive into your website because there's so much, but just like I joined your membership and I just because I want to learn about myself. And it's just so amazing to find language, to feel validated, and that you both are so vulnerable and that it's hard to do that, I think. But like what is most personal and intimate is really most universal and people identify. And I know that they're grateful. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on. Okay. Well, awkward goodbye time. So new episodes are out every single Friday on all major platforms, and we will see you next week.